All right, hello everybody. Welcome to Human Action, Austrian Sociology. For those of you who haven't taken any of my courses before, any courses from the Mises Academy, I just want to spend a little bit of time on how the course works. I give a lecture which usually lasts about an hour, and then we have half hour for discussion and comments, criticisms, anything you'd like. And you're free in the, while I'm lecturing, to post remarks in the chat box. And I don't always answer them immediately if they're during the lecture, but I sometimes do. But you're free to put the whatever you want in the chat, preferably on the lecture. Now, also, there is a weekly quiz, just voluntary for those who want to take the course for credit. I try to make these questions easy, although in some of my past classes I haven't been doing a good enough job because there are a few people who miss questions. I try to make them so they're pretty easy to get, you know, on the order of who was buried in Grant's tomb. Can anybody give me the correct, complete answer to that? Well, it's not only Grant, but Mrs. Grant is also buried in that tomb. So the complete answer would be Grant, Mrs. Grant. So it's not quite as easy as it sounded. Okay, so but enough of that. I'm supposed to not be telling so many jokes. So there's a weekly quiz if you want it to take it, and it's I try to make it easy, but you don't have to take it if you. It's completely up to you. Now, this course, I think it's one way. I think I'm glad you enrolled in this. I think you'll find it an enjoyable course because, for one thing, unlike the course I gave just before, which was on the first part of human action, we don't have to deal with a priori propositions, a priori concepts, a lot of this complicated philosophical stuff that many people find difficult. I like it because it keeps me in business, but a lot of people find that tough. But the section of human action we'll be dealing with in this course is, as I think you'll find, relatively easy to follow, but it's very important. And another thing, advantage we have in this course, we won't be dealing with a whole lot of reading. It's just part two of the book, which we're covering, is a not that many pages in it. And so the advantage of doing that, other than you don't have to do all that much reading, I put up some supplementary readings as well, but the advantage of that is we'll be able to go into more detail about what Mises is saying in the section if we're covering longer parts of the book. Then we have to pick and choose what are the things we want to cover, and we have to leave a lot out. But here we can be less selective, and we can get more of Mises' insights. And one thing I found when I was going over this material to prepare for the course, it's amazing how much Mises has packed in Human Action. I found, particularly when I was going over this section, there was one idea he had that he placed a great deal of weight on. I'll be getting to that in the lecture. I hadn't realized that this was so important to him, but we'll see. There's an extremely important idea that he's stressing in this chapter that I hadn't really seen before, the full weight that he wants to put on this idea. So what he's discussing in this section of the book is he's asking about a basic fact we find about human beings, that human beings live in society. There are, I suppose, a few people who just live by themselves, or maybe we could find some groups of people or just two or three people or just small families off by themselves. For the most part, we live in large groups of people. We have habitual relations with those people. Say you're all in most, I'm sure, in families, or you go to stores, you're in a job, you're all involved in the citizens of a particular country. We're all in these large groups. We're all in societies. So the question that comes up that Mises asked is a very basic question, is how did it come about that human beings are in society, and why are they in society? You could have different answers to those. You could take those as two separate questions, have different answers. You could say, well, human society came about in a certain way, but we're in society now for some different reason. But that isn't the way Mises goes. He has the same answer to how did societies, these large groups of people in these habitual relations, how did that come about, and why are people still in societies? So what is Mises' response? Why is it that we live in society? Mises is a social rationalist. There's a very good paper, I should have put it on the supplementary reading. Maybe Danny can add this, or we can put this in later, by Joe Salerno, called Mises as Social Rationalist. And what do we mean by this? That Mises thinks that the reason society began, the reason people started living in societies, and why we continue to do so, is that people recognize it's in their self-interest to do so. People recognize that we're much better off if we live in these large groups in a society than if we didn't. So one might think at first, oh, well, that can't be right, because if we're thinking how did society get together, it doesn't seem like people would just congregate and say, okay, we're going to start a society. You get that sometimes, the notion of a social contract as opposed to a contract of government. Locke has this in the Second Treatise, where he kind of imagines people who are getting together and deliberately deciding to form a society, but that doesn't seem like very likely. But this isn't what Mises means by that. He doesn't think that people just decide they're going to get together and say we'll form a society, but he means something else. He thinks that people recognize that they benefit from cooperating with others. So you'd have this first on a rather small scale. One way, let's say somebody has some food. Imagine we're in some kind of Stone Age situation. We imagine there's somebody else who has some food we want. It's nice. He's cooking some nice buffalo steak, and we'd like some. So one thing we could do is just go up to him and hit him over the head and try to take it away from him. But people recognize that's a very risky thing to do. What if the person is stronger and does it to us? We could gain much more instead of just trying to take it away from him. Maybe we could give him something that he wants in exchange for his giving us some of the food. We could benefit from trading with the other person. People recognize that cooperating with others is to their mutual interest. So see, this is what makes Mises a social rationalist. He's thinking The reason, or the main reason, people get together is that they realize cooperation will help them. This is a conscious process. They're not having in mind from the start they're going to form a big society, but they do recognize that cooperating with particular people will help them. We can have peaceful exchange. And one of the main advantages of cooperation, of exchanging goods and services, that Mises places the most stress on is the division of labor. What does division of labor mean? Well, supposing, let's say, imagine we have to produce everything we need for ourselves, say we need food or we need some place to stay. So imagine we had to grow all our own food or get all our own food in some way instead of going down to the store and getting it. We just had to make or grow everything ourselves. If we wanted a house, we had to provide that. We had to chop down all the wood and just build the house for ourselves. We wouldn't get very far. If you're someone like me, we wouldn't be able to survive at all. If, however, we specialize, say, particular people do one thing, like some people are carpenters and build houses, other people are farmers. We all specialize in producing different things and then exchange what we produce with other people. We'll have much more than we would if we tried to produce everything by ourselves. Now, how far does this go? Let's say we benefit from division of labor and peaceful exchange. There are no fixed limits to this. It isn't that, well, cooperation is good, say, if it goes just with a certain number of people, but then after that, then cooperation isn't worth anything. There's no fixed limit. We can extend cooperation, division of labor, trade indefinitely. So this is how society develops. Now I see there's a question from Ryan. Says, I would be interested to know what you think about the concept of Dunbar's number. There's an upper limit to the number of people we can deal with in a personal way. Well, that's not something I've studied, but you notice that's a different point from the one I'm discussing now. And I think in order to benefit from division of labor and exchange, we don't have to have close personal relations with people. Say, imagine, say you go into a store and buy something, you don't have to be friends with the clerk, or sometimes, say, we order things up on the internet or by telephone, we don't even know the people at all we're dealing with. Sometimes we're not dealing with people, we call somebody up and there's all these buttons you have to push that gives you a recording, so you're not dealing with anyone at all. You see, if this notion that you're raising, there's an upper limit to number of people we can deal with in a personal way, it sounds plausible. I mean, we can only devote our attention to so many people. After all, there's a limit to how many people we can have close relations with. That seems very plausible. That doesn't prevent us from cooperating, benefiting through market exchange with a whole lot of people. There's no limit to the number of people we can be involved with in division of labor and market. In fact, if you take the world, there are billions of people who are linked to each other through the exchanges of various sorts. Now, in order to understand Mises' views on society, we have to grasp the fundamental point he makes, that when we're talking about society, we just mean this individuals who are living together in large groups and have habitual relations with each other. it isn't a society, isn't some independent entity that exists apart from the individuals in it. So it isn't as if, say, we take the United States as a society. It isn't that, well, you have all the people in the United States, but there's something called the United States as well that exists apart from these individuals. There's some kind of separate entity. So if we say the society or the nation acts, this just means that particular persons act. Say if the United States declared war on Japan December 8, 1941, that is to be explained by saying Congress, in response to a request from President Roosevelt, declared war, and because of the legal structure of the U.S., that involved that other people would be doing other things, and eventually this led to people fighting Japan or doing things to Japan. But it wasn't that, well, Congress did something, and then we could also ask, there's some kind of separate entity, the United States, that declared war. It's just these particular people. Incidentally, if you haven't already listened to, you can listen to this on YouTube and other places. Everybody should listen to President Roosevelt's call for declaration of war on this Monday, December 8th. It's one of the great speeches. I mean, I'm certainly not a fan of Franklin Roosevelt, but he was a great, had a great dramatic delivery. Everybody should listen to that. Now, this view that I've just given, that society isn't an independent entity, but it just consists of individuals and the relations that they're in, is called methodological. Mises called this methodological individualism. He's actually talked about that in the first part of the book. But this is what he's applying this notion here. I should say, I didn't put this in the slide, but I think it's interesting. You might think, why is Mises putting so much stress on this? In that, doesn't it seem obvious that that's true, that nobody would say, oh, well, there's some kind of society independent exists apart from particular people, but there are people who held that view. There definitely are people who hold that view, and we'll be mentioning this a little later on, that the particular opinion Mises attacking does say that there's a society independent of the individuals that compose it. Now, as I say, Mises, again, getting back to this point about it's individuals who compose society, and the individuals form society and remain in society because they see it's in their interest to do so. Now, that, I would say, that is not the dominant theory today. I think people who talk about origin of society would have various evolutionary explanations for how society arose. And one view that's popular, Adam Smith was one of the first to, one of the important people who talked about this in his theory of moral sentiment, is that human beings sympathize with each other. Say, if I see someone else is happy, that will tend to make me happy, other things being equal. Or if I see someone suffering, I'll tend to feel bad. So people have common feelings with each other, and this draws people together. So on this theory, which is not one that Mises holds, the way society got together is people have feelings for other people, and this draws them together. Now, Mises doesn't accept this theory. So if you say, oh, but look, isn't it true, at least to some extent, that people have fellow feelings for other people? If say we saw, I saw there was a story in the paper that this television actress Valerie Harper has terminal brain cancer. So wouldn't we feel sad about that even if we don't know her? Wouldn't we have some kind of fellow feeling for her? And we watch this basis of our, say we have the appeal of movies and fiction. We're drawn into the emotions of other people and authors who can, movie producers can use this to arouse our interest, that people tend to be drawn to each other. So couldn't we say, oh, well, Mises is wrong because people do have sympathy for each other. But Mises, of course, is aware of this. He doesn't deny that people sympathize with each other. But he says this is the outcome of society, not the cause of society. As he sees it, people, once people see the benefits of cooperation and exchange, they should be they rather than they. Missed that one. They'll tend to sympathize with those who cooperate with them. Let's get back to that example I gave where somebody's cooking a buffalo steak and somebody else sees, well, if I offer him something that he wants, I'll be able to get some food from him. So if you make an exchange with someone, both benefit, this will tend to make you like the person and sympathize with them. But in Mises' view, it's the pursuit of self-interest that comes first. People are see that cooperating with each other will benefit them, and then when they do that, they'll sympathize with other people. It isn't that the sympathy comes first. I think there's a question from Garth, who are some of the philosophers behind the sympathy theory? Well, you find that in, I'd say, Adam Smith or various people in the 19th century who had it. I think Gabriel Tard was one. You find that in Emil Durkheim, I think, to some extent. It's a very common view. Now, and I see a question from Ani. So it says, I think that what you're suggesting there is right. There may be a limit to the number of people we can have close personal relation with, but it doesn't follow from that that there's a limit to the number of people we can engage in cooperative exchange with. So you're exactly right. That was what I was trying to get at. Now, there's a related explanation of the origin of society, is that human beings have what's called a consciousness of kind. So we recognize that other people are like us. We're all human beings, or say we could view ourselves, sometimes people view ourselves as members of a lesser group, like we're all members of the same tribe, or we're all related to each other in various ways. Say, if you look at Greek and Roman history, look the city-states in Athens, they're organized on certain tribes, people related to each other. This is very important, but people viewed themselves, they were as related to certain, biologically related to certain other people, and that was very important to how they, the place they had in society. You get that in the Roman Republic also. Now this phrase, consciousness of kind, comes from a Columbia sociologist, Franklin Giddings. I would think it's likely, or possible anyway, Mises might have heard from this from his student, Eric Voegelin, who was in his private seminar, was an Austrian philosopher and thinker, who was very impressed by Giddings. Voegelin had taken a trip to the United States, and he wrote a book which was published in German, later translated, something on the form of the American spirit, and he was very impressed by Giddings. So this may well be why Mises knew about him, that he was fairly close to Vogel, and perhaps they discussed it. What Mises says about this, he says he can accept this if it only if you take this phrase to mean recognition of the benefits of social cooperation. So for Mises, again, it's people rationally come to realize that they benefit from exchanging with other people because this permits division of labor to do its work. It isn't, again, that they all come together and say we're going to form a large society, but they benefit from cooperation. There's no fixed limit to how much you can benefit from cooperation with how many people you can benefit. So society comes about through in that way. Now, I want to raise now an objection that can be raised what Mises is saying, the people who give this as an objection both to Austrian economics and also to libertarian political theory. What this objection is that here we're putting stress on, we're starting with individual people and saying, well, individuals recognize the benefit of cooperating with each other, so then they'll get together, they'll form groups, and then these groups will get larger because the benefits of cooperation can be extended. But the objection is, isn't it wrong to start with individuals? Because after all, individuals don't just spring up on their own. We're all born into a previously existing society. So we're not just born isolated beings. We're born into society. That actually was an objection that John C. Calhoun, the American supporter of nullification and Great Southern politician, raised to John Locke. He said, well, look, individuals don't come first. We're born into families and we're all dependent on other people. There's an objection also. The contemporary philosopher Alasdair MacIntyre has a book called Dependent Rational Animals where he makes a similar point. And what would Mises say in response? What does he say? Well, he admits this. He says, sure, people are born into society, but it doesn't follow from that that society exists apart from persons. Rather, it's that individuals are socialized by persons who are already alive when they're born. So this fact that individuals are born into society doesn't refute, it doesn't go counter to methodological individualism, because all it's saying is that individuals are born into group, into a situation where other individuals have preceded them and are raising them. And now, of course, now you might wonder, well, how do the first individuals get there? But that's fortunately something we don't have to answer in this course. Now, I now want to get, you remember when I started the lecture, I said when I was going through the material to get ready for this course, there was something I hadn't realized before, how strong a theme this was in this section, how much emphasis Mises is placing on this point. I think Danny said we need a societal regression theorem. Well, but we can only obtain that by starting with Barter. no doubt. Okay, so we now want to get what this point is, what this thing point is. I think Mises is placing so much emphasis on, and this is a division he establishes between two theories of society. Now, what I'm going to say immediately will start like I'm just making the same point I've already made, but this isn't what I'm. This next sentence isn't this new contribution. It's something that arises from this division. So this division is one we've already talked about, is between theories that view society as nothing but individuals and their relations, and theories that view society as an independent entity that exists apart from individuals. As we've already talked about, of course, we know Mises is on the side that the society exists is nothing but individuals and their relations. It isn't an independent entity. But this point I hadn't realized is what Mises wants to do with this division. It's a consequence he draws from it, or at least what he says is, it's something he says about the conclusions, what he says about the theories that claim society exists independently of individuals. So suppose you do say that, he thinks, then you're going to get into a problem because you'll have a conflict between what individuals want to do and the requirements of society. On his theory, say we say, why do we obey certain social rules? Say we have a rule we're not supposed to aggress against other people, say, if, let's take an example, let's imagine just hypothetically that I do a very negative book review of somebody, and that person's followers all start saying, or many of them start saying bad things about me. So I'm not supposed to go out and shoot all the people who say bad things about me, much as I'd like to. So the question is, why do I obey that rule? Now, on Mises' view, of why is it rational for me to obey that rule? Not why do I obey it, it's probably because I've been trained to do that, but you say, why is it rational for me to obey a rule, not to initiate force against people, even people I don't like? And then the answer on the individual's view that Mises takes is, I can recognize it's in my interest to do so. I'll be better off if I obey that rule than if I don't, because if that rule weren't in effect, if people could just start hitting and killing each other whenever they wanted, then we couldn't have a society of where we'd be cooperating with each other and benefit from the division of labor. But suppose you say, no, society is independent, and we draw a distinction between what individuals want and what we have to do for society. So on that view, Mises, well, then people have to be forced to follow the dictates of society. Society is an independent entity that has certain requirements, and then people have to follow that whether they want to or not. So there's going to be a conflict, because on that view, suppose, say, I won't be saying I'm following these generally accepted rules because it's in my interest to do so. I'll say maybe it isn't in my interest. I'd like to get around those rules, but society is an independent entity, and society says I have to do this. So there's going to be a big conflict there. And how, the question would then come up, will I be forced to follow the social rules? How will it be that I have to do this, even if it isn't in my interest to do so? Because remember, this theory that society is an independent entity is saying that your social rules aren't there because they benefit you. They're there because society, which is this independent body, establishes them. So now here we get to what I think is this big point. I hadn't realized how much Mises is stressing this. He says, if suppose people have to do what society requires, then we have a question, well, who's going to make them do this? There'll have to be people who say society requires you to do something. There'll have to be a group of people who are saying what the requirements of society is. And then the question will come up, how do those people know what society requires? If you have, say, some group saying, you have to do such and such because society, which is this independent entity, needs you to do that, how do the people who say that know what it is that society requires? Now, at last, we get to this point that Mises is wanting to stress. He thinks that those questions, namely, who is going to force people to obey the requirements of society, and how do those people know what society requires, they can only be answered if you postulate a superhuman or divine origin of society. So on this view, there's a priestly caste, a priestly group, who has privileged access to God's requirements. So to give the example that I gave before, why is it that I can't go out and and get rid of all the people who said nasty things about me just because I wrote a negative review of a certain person who thought he was a philosopher but wasn't? Why can't I go out and get rid of those people? On this view, it's that people who are claim to be in special touch with God know that this rule, namely that I can't, that people shouldn't murder each other, is one that God wants, and they've established it. So in this view, Mises thinks that people who say that society is an independent entity with separate requirements apart from self-interest, he thinks will be driven to assuming some kind of divine origin theory of society, which I'll say, how do we know what the interests of this separate entity are apart from interests of individuals? We can get this through access to what God wants. So there's some group that says, we know what God wants, and this is why people have to obey the social rules. It isn't that these rules are in people's interest. Now, as you probably will surmise if you haven't read this section already, Mises rejects that approach, that's to say the approach where you say that society is an independent entity and we know what the requirements of society are because particular people or groups have access to God's requirements, so they know what the requirements of society are. So Mises said, well, this is an unscientific approach because it's going beyond human reason. It's saying people, this privileged groups, has some sort of access to divine revelation or some other source that gives them a superhuman understanding of what is required by society. Now you might think, oh, well, maybe there are theories like that, but aren't they largely irrelevant? I mean, there are certainly theological views around, but aren't there all sorts of other theories also that are not methodologically individualist in Mises' sense? So why does Mises place so much stress on this theological theory? Aren't there all sorts of non-theological theories that are not individualist in his sense? But here we get to a very important point in this chapter, that Mises has a very broad view of which theories count as divine origin accounts. And basically, he takes practically any view that isn't methodologically individualist to be a divine origin account or superhuman origin account. For example, he considers Marxism. Of course, Marx was a very strong atheist. It sounds odd to class Marx with divine origin accounts of society, but Mises does, because remember, in the Marxist theory, what you have is Marx says that there's a constant tendency in history for what he calls the forces of production to develop. The force of production is very roughly the technology that exists at a particular time. So Mises says there's a constant tendency in history for the forces of production to keep developing, keep getting better and more elaborate, more efficient, so on. And the relations of production, how people are organized to produce things, are determined by the forces of production. And he has a whole theory of history based on this. Theory of society, if you're interested in that, you could look at Mises' treatment of Marxism in theory and history. But the point we have to bear in mind here, which is the key point here, is that what Marx is saying, according to Mises, is that the force of the production is something that's developing independently of human will and decision. It's as if it's an entity that's just is developing by itself. So this counts for Marx as a superhuman account of society. It's classed with these divine origin accounts. I see Kevin has asked, like Hegel's view of society, of history, yes, very much so, and Mises mentioned that Hegel had what he calls the world spirit, the Weltgeist, which is developing throughout history. It's coming, the absolute is coming to consciousness. Don't ask me to explain what that means, but at least the way Mises takes it, it's something that the world spirit is independent of human consciousness. Human consciousness is part of the world spirit, comes to consciousness in human beings, but it's an independent entity. So this, again, is an appeal to a supernatural cause. And so Mises is classifying a lot of things as divine origin as supernatural that you wouldn't ordinarily take to be so. Mises, as I say, thinks this difference between the self-interested rational view of society that he holds to be the correct one, that society arises by people recognizing that cooperation, social cooperation, and the division of labor are in their interest, the division between that theory and this other theory that society is an independent entity, and to know its requirements we have to have some knowledge by non-rational means of a superhuman or divine entity. He thinks that struggle between those theories is really the key to understanding the Enlightenment, the 18th century Enlightenment. He sees the Enlightenment as a battle for the rationalistic theory of society against the divine origin theory. So divine, again, doesn't have to mean appeal to God of that we know of Christianity or Judaism in the organized religion, but it's any theory that is postulating some kind of superhuman entity. So Mises said this is really the key struggle in the Enlightenment. Now, it doesn't follow from what he said so far that in order to accept the Enlightenment theory, this theory that society comes about as a result of individuals recognizing that cooperation is in their interest, and society doesn't exist as an entity apart from the individual. It doesn't follow, if you accept that, that you have to be an atheist. He immediately points out that both Adam Smith and Friedrich Bastiat believed in God, but they maintained this individualistic view of society. So it isn't that in order to be a good Misesian, you have to be an atheist. And in fact, one thing I think is interesting to note, when Mises was rejecting these views that they're people who have knowledge of what, a special knowledge of what God requires for society, he was actually in accord with a certain trend in 20th century theology, that there was a movement, say you find this in the great Protestant theologian Karl Barth, that God's revelation to human beings is something really apart from the historical process, that we can't look at history and then find within secular history a divine pattern and get access to it, that then we'd be able to know what we have to do. The revelation of God is something between human beings and God, not something that takes place through history, apart, of course, from the particular events of involved in Revelation. So Mises actually is in accord there with a certain trend in 20th century theology. You find this also in C.S. Lewis, who was one who rejected the notion of being able to find a pattern in history of theological significance. So Mises was actually in accord with certain trends in theology. Now, one point, I think this is an especially important one, interesting one, is that this division that I talked about between this view that society is based on individual interest, self-interest, people recognize the need to cooperate, and this other view, society is an independent entity with requirements of its own, and there's a privileged group who have access to the supernatural knowledge of these requirements. This division he also extended to ethics. And he had a similar division in ethics. He said that ethical theories can be divided into those based on individual self-interest and those based on the demands of some non-human source. So what would be example? So one theory, say, if you took in his view, a utilitarian theory would say, well, what we're trying to do in ethics is what find out what will make people happy. And Mises said, what will make people happy is cooperation through the market. That's the most important thing. So and we can get from that certain ethical principles like not to aggress against other people, respect for private property, because this will enable cooperation to take place through the market. So on this view, if you take the standard rules of ethics, they would be based on individual self-interest. And in the sense, if you don't do that, then you're going to have to base the demands of ethics on some non-human source. You'll be saying, well, these requirements are just out there. Maybe they come from God or some other non-human source, but they're not based on individual self-interest. Mises calls those theories heteronomous, you see, as opposed to autonomous, meaning they're coming from the individual. Heteronomous is from outside the individual. Now, here, I think Mises' use of this term heteronomous is a bit ironical, because Kant, Immanuel Kant, has a very different use of heteronomous in his ethics. Kant thinks that it's wrong to say that ethics comes from individual self-interest. He thinks ethics is, we get ethics are pure demands of reason, not based on self-interest. And he thinks that if you base ethics on self-interest, that's what he considers an example of a heteronomous theory. But Mises uses heteronomous to mean not based on individual self-interest. So again, the basic division for Mises is between ethical theories that are based on individual self-interest and those based on some non-human source. It parallels this division we have in Explanation of Society between views that say society is based on recognition of individual interest, self-interest, and those that say no, society is an independent entity and with demands of its own that stem from some non-human source. Now, it's important when I say according to Mises, when I say according to Mises, morality is in everybody's interest, we mean by that it's everybody's long-term self-interest. For example, maybe I'd feel better right now if I just hauled off and socked somebody I didn't like, but it wouldn't be in my long-term self-interest to do so. So we're all better off if we live, for example, in a society where physical aggression is prohibited. But this point about long-term self-interest is very important, because suppose we just left that out, then you have the question, why is it that some people act immorally? Some people do bad things. Suppose you say morality's in our interest, but how would you explain then why some people don't act morally? Don't they see that what they're doing is against their own interest? So how is it they act immorally if morality's in our interest? But people don't always do what's in, like, have their, it should be T-H-E-I-R, blind, making a lot of mistakes here. So people sometimes don't act on their long-term interest, so coercion is needed to enforce moral obligation, because people are sometimes very short-sighted. They just do what they want to do right now. Excuse me, I'm losing my voice here. Even if it isn't in their long-term interest. So it isn't that when Mises is talking about morality based on self-interest that he thinks that you can just, that just gets rid of any appeal to people having to do what they don't want to do, because people sometimes don't want to do what's in their long-term interest. Now, one interesting point here is that he thinks anarchists ignore this point, namely the point that sometimes people will act immorally because even though following the rules of morality is in their long-term interest, they won't act on their long-term interest. It Mises takes anarchists to think that people will cooperate without any enforcement mechanism to get them not to aggress and keep agreements. So if Mises is taking anarchism, it's we don't need any government because people just cooperate by themselves. And I think it's clear here that Mises wasn't thinking of libertarian anarchists who want competing protection agencies. See, the difference is a libertarian anarchist like Murray Rothbard would say we shouldn't have monopoly agency protecting us. We should allow competition, have a market in protection agencies just like market and other things. But Rothbard certainly isn't saying we could just get rid of protection services because in a free society, everybody would just cooperate and nobody would aggress against anybody else. We wouldn't need any enforcement. So when Mises is criticizing anarchism, what he has in mind are people like Prince Peter Kropotkin, who take a very rosy view of human nature, think that people, at least under certain conditions, will just cooperate without the need for any enforcement. Prince Kropotkin was very interesting, for he came from one of the highest noble families in Russia, but he became an anarchist. And now, the last topic I want to mention is, we have the question, of course, we know Mises wasn't an anarchist. He believed in a government. But we have a question. He has an interesting view on how that government should be organized. He thinks we should have democracy, by which he means rule by the majority. And his argument for this is very different from the way most people who are supporters of democracy support democracy. He says that he thinks first, and here he's echoing things we find in Etienne de la Boetie and David Hume, that all government rests on popular consent. In what sense? It isn't that everybody always likes the government, but if people say that the government will consist of a relatively small number of people, and if masses of people refuse to obey the government wouldn't be able to force them to do so. I mean, supposing, for example, people just decided we're not going to pay our taxes anymore. We couldn't get the IRS wouldn't be able to do very much about it if we just had massive disobedience. So people have to be willing to accept the government for the government to function. In that sense, there's no such thing as a long-term unpopular government, according to Mises, because if it became unpopular, people would just stop obeying it. I mean, there are various problems we could raise with that claim, but that was what Mises thought. Now, what happens, though, if the government, people don't like the government anymore? What's going to happen then? The government will be overthrown and replaced with something else, because if a government that people just don't like sufficiently, they'll disobey, it won't be able to survive. So governments that don't suit the people in this very strong sense, or weak sense actually, because it's not saying that people have to like the government, it's just people have to tolerate enough to that they'll be willing to do what the government says. So if people stop doing that, then the government will be overthrown. And what Mises says about democracy is this makes peaceful change possible, because let's say people stop obeying, a lot of people stop obeying the government, then some other group will try to take over. If you don't have a democracy, then you'll have fights between the people trying to stay in power and the new groups. But if you have a democracy, Mises thinks, then you can have a peaceful change of government. So this, I think there, as I say, the various problems one could raise with this argument, this was Mises' argument for democracy. Okay, so I think at that point, we'll finish now. We can go to question. I see somebody's recommended Hans Hoppe and another book. Yes, I think Hans Hoppe, I don't know this other book you mentioned, but the one by Hans is certainly worth reading. Unless he said, didn't Mises have a rosy view? But yes, I think he did, and I think Hans Hoppe criticized him actually in that book, Democracy, the God That Failed, on those grounds. But he did tend to be very sympathetic to democracy. Now, Kevin says, why is natural law theory not heteronomous in Mises' sense? Does law ignore methodological, or does it take that into account? Does it speak to mankind instead of individual men? Well, Mises doesn't say all that. I mean, he has some discussion of natural law theory, but I think he tends to take that as a theological view, that it's supposed to be one. Natural law theory claims that it's just deducing requirements of human nature from reason, but Mises tended to doubt whether Catholic natural law theory really did that. Now, to the extent it did, we're just talking what was in people's self-interest, and I don't think he'd be opposed to it. So, the natural law theory he opposes more of a Catholic theological one. And I have a question here. Did Mises support universal suffrage? Well, I don't think he discusses limitations on suffrage in any great length, but he believed in majority rule. I mean, whether there could be any limitations, I don't think he addresses that in any great detail. I see here what Mises, more Kantian, has been said, extended some Kantian ideas into econ sociology. Has anyone taken Mises' lead and expanded on this? His Kantian side comes in more. This is in the part one, and we're discussing ideas on theory of knowledge. I don't think very many people have. Hans Hoppe has written something on this. He has kind of an extension of Mises' Kantian views on theory of knowledge. Guido Holtzmann, at least in his dissertation, had something on this also, but that hasn't been a topic that's been taken up by very many people. It's interesting. You have to draw a very sharp distinction here between epistemology, theory of knowledge, and ethics, because Mises was very sympathetic to Kant in theory of knowledge, but not in ethics. He was very anti-Kantian in ethics. So it's an interesting combination. He's very pro-Kant theory of knowledge and anti-Kant in his ethics. Kevin asked a question, is there a human action part three? Well, there are a lot of parts of human action. I take it you're meaning, is there a third part of this course? That I don't know. I mean, I don't have anything planned for that. But, and then you say, or will we finish the book in this class. No, we're only going to be doing part two of the book in this class. So we won't be finishing up the book in this class. We're just talking about a small section of the book. Now, Colin says, isn't all government unpopular in the long term? And now Danny says, yes. Danny, is that yes in response to Colin's question, or is that referring to something else? Oh, there will be. Oh, good. Well, I'm not sure that I'll be teaching it, but somebody will. Now, in response to the question from Colin, isn't all government unpopular in the long term? I don't think it would have to be. I mean, supposing we just have a government and people just tolerate it, they're willing to do what it says. I mean, I don't think why would, I don't, I mean, it might be that particular governments would become unpopular, but I don't see why all governments would have to ultimately fail. I mean, maybe there is some argument that shows that, but I don't know. I'm not seeing what it is. Here's one from Travis. Why do Mises stray away from natural rights? Rothbard seemed dismayed that Mises never took a natural rights position. Well, Mises thought, favored this utilitarian idea that, as I was trying to explain, that morality comes as expression of individual self-interest. And he thought natural rights would, if they're considered as apart from legal rights, which are something that you would establish on a basis of what's in people's interest. He thought if you just postulate natural rights, that would be arbitrary. You'd just be saying, well, people have certain rights, but what in his view, if you don't appeal to this utilitarian consideration, in his view, that would be arbitrary. He was influenced, remember Bentham, the great, the founder of utilitarian, said natural rights are nonsense on stilts. Natural imprescriptible rights, which was from the French Declaration of Rights, are nonsense on stilts. So I think Mises accepted that view. I don't know that he was right to do that, but that was his position. Michael says many conservatives claim that what we need is a society of saints. How does Mises reverse this thing? Well, I think conservatives, I'm not quite, yes, I think Bob is right. I think they tend to say people are tainted by original sin, and that's why we need a strong government to repress people. Of course, then they have a problem. Well, wouldn't the people in the government also be tainted by sin? So I think Mises, I think, assumes that people are self-interested, and that they're not saints, but they're not irredeemably hostile to each other either. Now, Brian said Mises was an apolitical utilitarian. Well, he's certainly a utilitarian. I mean, I think he had certain political views from time to time. He wasn't identified with a particular political party, but he was certainly utilitarian. Now, Matthew says, how would Mises define collectivism? Is it the view that collectivism is an autonomous existence, or is the elevation of the goals of the collective above those of the individual? I think Mises thought those two went together, that there is a collective interest that's collective, that has an existence apart from the individual, and the goal, what the goals of that independent entity are, more important than the goals of the individual. Now, there's one point where Mises discusses a position held by Max Stirner, who was in left Hegelian, kind of an individualist anarchist, and he thought, he apparently accepted the view that society is an independent entity, but he thought, if it is, then the individual's goals are more important than those of the collective entity. So he said, all right, well, society is this independent body, but who cares about that? But that's most people who think society is an independent entity do think that what its goals override those of the individual. So individuals have to be compelled to do what they are supposed to. Oh, now Brian says, what I meant by apolitical was that without interpersonal comparison of utility, it would be impossible to select policy to impose. You certainly couldn't have policies based on interpersonal comparison of utility if you can't make such comparisons. But I mean, you could have other grounds for policy, like you could show that certain policies wouldn't achieve the aims of the people who favor them, like minimum wage laws or other things. I think you could have some room for political action apart from personal comparisons of utility. Now, Phillips, wait, let me just see. Phil says, who is to decide if a given individual is acting in his or her self-interest? If one does assert a universal metric, one can't measure it. One does assert a universal metric, we take a straight stride in the direction of maximizing social utility, which will run counter to self-interest of many individuals. I think Moniz would say there is, I think he would, there are certain things, whether what's in people's long-term self-interest, as he thinks, is a matter of fact, that we can say that cooperation through the market is in people's self-interest. It isn't, I mean, there are particular goals that people have that, of course, just matters of personal preference, but he thinks that nearly everyone will find it rational to favor social cooperation. So I think where your question is going along the wrong lines, it seems to me, talking about universal metric. I think metric is the wrong word to use here. It's suggesting some kind of measurement, but you can have something that's true, that's universally true, without saying you're measuring something. It's just, it is the case that people benefit from social cooperation, but that doesn't imply you're measuring something. So you wouldn't have to say, how do you get a maximum of this particular measure, and say sacrifice the interests of some people to others on the grounds that will maximize utility. That's a problem certain kinds of utilitarian systems get into. You're very right to bring that up, but it's not what, that's not the way Mises is going. Now, Collins said, did Mises ever talk about his views on the U.S. Constitution Bill of Rights? There is a passage I'm thinking of. I think it may be in his short book, Bureaucracy, where he's talking about American conservatives who stress adherence to the Constitution, and they say FDR and the New Deal are unconstitutional, so that's what's wrong. And Mises said, well, something like, they may be right, but he doesn't think that's the most important way of criticizing economic interventionism like the New Deal. He thinks the best way to do it is to say that these measures of intervention don't work. They would go against the self-interest of the people. They wouldn't achieve the aims that their advocates say. So he doesn't reject the U.S. Constitution or Bill of Rights, but it isn't his primary emphasis. He likes his own way of doing things. Oh, that's interesting. Now, Danny has a passage that Sound Money is to be classed with political constitutional bills of rights. I say he's not rejecting that, but I mean, he doesn't place the primary emphasis on criticizing something because it goes against the Constitution. But that's a very good passage. I hadn't thought of that. Yeah, I mean, sound money is preventing, say, people from inflating or seizing currency from other people or so on. Now, Anish says, wait a sec. Given that Mises' argument for democracy is an existing utilitarian one, if Hoppe's ideas in democracy that God that failed or correct, would Mises change his view on democracy suitability as a political system? Well, that would be, I think the key there would just be what he found Hoppe's views convincing. I don't know that, I mean, that's something we could only speculate on. I tend to think he would have stayed with what he thought, but I mean, that's something I don't know. I mean, whether the views are correct, I don't know. We could ask, are the views that Hans says is correct? That would be something we could discuss. But the question you ask would be rather more amorphous on would Mises have changed his view on him. That would depend on whether he thought they were correct or not. And I don't see what we could say about this. Now, here's another quotation that Mises says, he tends to take the purpose of constitutional bills of rights is to limit the power of the government to interfere with the market economy. Oh, now, Anish said, we can't tell what he would present. The question more about the arguments. Now I see. So what you want to know is, are Hans's arguments against democracy good? Well, I'm inclined to think there's a lot in them. Now I think one of his arguments is he's comparing democracies unfavorably with monarchies, and he says, well, democratic government, the government is just in for a limited period of time, so they won't have an incentive to conserve resources. They'll just try to gain as much as possible for themselves. But the monarch, if you have a monarchy, it will be able to take a more long-term perspective because the monarch will know that its family will be around indefinitely, so it can conserve resources. I mean, I think there's something to that, but I think the main point I would make is, both Hans and Mises would agree, this main thing is we need to limit government as much as possible, preferably getting rid of it altogether. I think Hans would say that, Mises wouldn't, but if we just limit government as much as possible, that's the most important thing. Now, Colin said, is Hoppe rejecting natural law because it is all in favor of something else? Yes, I think Hans has his own view based on his argumentation ethics. I don't think that would be it. His version isn't a version of natural law. It isn't saying what are the requirements of human nature, but it's more what is rationally required by the presuppositions of argument, which we can't reject. Now, Collins says, Rothbard said in a lecture he doesn't buy the monarchy long-term perspective. He said he thought the monarch has an incentive to crush and rob you. Well, this is an interesting point. You see, one thing I think is a problem with Hans's view is that Hans would be right if the monarch regarded the entire society is his personal estate, and he would be then say, how can I maximize the gains over the long term for my personal estate? But monarchs generally don't, that isn't the relation between a monarch and the people he's ruling over. People have independent property, and the monarch's estate isn't the sum. Even if a monarch is ruling over people, he doesn't have a direct, I mean, he doesn't regard everybody's property as immediately his own. So, I mean, I think it doesn't follow the monarch would be interested in conserving everybody's property to the greatest extent possible, but more his personal estate, I think. So I think that is a problem with Hans's view. I mean, maybe there's something to it. I mean, that would just be an empirical matter, I think. Oh, now here's one from Leslie. Nietzsche has an interesting argument: democracy leads to decay of the state because it first undermines religion. When religion became a matter of conscience, it does under democracy, state lose its divine origin, aura, and over time the state will decay as people see its usefulness. Well, that's a very interesting point. You get in something in Tocqueville also has a view that there's a kind of popular religion becomes more sentimental, and so perhaps there's something to this, although what if you had, say, religion became a matter of individual conscience? So I see some Nietzsche saying the state lose its divine origin, but would it follow that the state would be sufficiently weakened that it would decay, or just maybe you could have this powerful state that didn't rely on divine origin? So Nietzsche seems to be assuming that in order for it to have a powerful state that would keep going, it would have to, people would have to take it as somehow divine. So I think that would be the point that would have to be investigated. Has another satisfactory rationalization of democracy, majority rule, been put forward? Well, I don't think there have been. There are various arguments that people have given for democracy, but I don't find them that good. I mean, one, you'll find that one popular one is, if, let's assume that people tend to be slightly better than average in determining what's a good policy. I mean, that's a very dubious assumption. But suppose you assume that people tend to be slightly better than random in voting for good policy. Suppose a measure comes up, says that we want to do, say we're going to impose new taxes, and then people would say, you imagine people deciding it, we just flip a coin on whether they have a policy, then you assume that people are slightly better than random in deciding what to do. Then you could show, if people are slightly better than random, if you get more and more people together voting, you can show some mathematically, it's called the Condorcet theorem, that you'll get a very good chance people would pick the right policy. Now, Danny says, according to Donald Livingston, David Hume thought empires were more brutal when they're headed by democracies. Oh yes, that's very interesting. Yes, Phil says, wisdom of crowds. Wouldn't they that rely far more on direct democracy than democracy by many? Not actually, if you take this Condorcet view. Now, of course, the problem with the Condorcet theory, if people are below random in picking what the best policy was, then you get a very good argument against democracy. And then there are other problems with that, like you could have smaller groups. You could justify elite rule. Variation of the conversation to justify elite rule also. That's a popular view that's been in some of the current literature. Now, Phil said they have to pick groups of policies, though. They don't receive referendum on many issues. Yes, that's right, but I mean, you could just raise the same point, supposing people are good at, if you take a group of policies, suppose you see people are better than random and picking out which group of policies is better, then you could still apply this theorem. Now, some say everyone has a say and no one person gets the total say. Yes, I mean, there are arguments for democracy that go just in the way you've suggested, say, no one should have greater rights to rule than anybody else. Now, I prefer to take that in a more libertarian way and say each person should have jurisdiction over his or her own affairs rather than say a majority should rule over the rest of us. I see Travis recommend Michael Humer's book. I think that's a very good book. I hope to review that. I'm a bit behind in my reviews, but Humer sent me the book, so I'm very nice with my I read it and I think very highly, but that is a very good book to read. Yes, self-ownership, yes, that's exactly what I think is much better than democracy. Now, Bob says, if I can whack you on the head and take your, get away with it, who's to say it's wrong? So what if your society came up with a rule against it if I don't get caught? Isn't morality merely a social construct? Well, I wouldn't agree with that. I mean, you could certainly think that, but I mean, would you hold, say, when you say, who's to say it's wrong in quotation marks, I would suggest if somebody took something from you, you'd be saying it's wrong in more than quotation marks. It's just you may think so, you may deny that simply because you're in the grip of a certain theory, but I tend to think that goes against our ordinary, we were suggesting, goes against our ordinary moral judgments. Now, resisting democracy requires a populace with a certain level of intelligence, wisdom, foresight. No, it would work better with that, but Mises favors democracy just on the grounds that you'll prevent violent social change. The government can be changed peacefully, so that would apply even if people weren't very intelligent or wise. Now let's see. Travis says you should never use force. Well, what about responding to force by others? Force and aggression aren't the same thing. Now, Danny says France certainly seemed less oppressive under the Ancien regime than when it became a republic. See, especially the Levant en Masse and the war in Vendée. Yes, I think that's a very good point. I mean, we could certainly have a less oppressive government. I mean, that would be a bit, I mean, that would be, your point is a very good one. It would be, now, could Mises say anything there? Well, I think he might say, if the Ancien regime could have been changed peacefully, things would have been much better, we wouldn't have had a revolution. There wouldn't have been a revolution against it. So he could accept your point, but think it's consistent with his point of, with his point. Now we're out of time here, but I see Ryan has asked a question about Molyneux. I don't think I as we say, I'm not going to go there, but you remember in the lecture I was giving an example of I was giving an example that applies to him. Okay, well, I think we're about out of time now. Someone asked when did music first develop his thoughts on democracy. Do you think he was affected by any certain contemporary event? I don't know. I think that those views were, that wasn't such an unusual review at the time. It was one held by a certain type of European classical liberal. It was a popular view at the time, so I don't know any particular event that got him going on it, but maybe there was. Okay, well, I guess we're out of time, so thanks everybody for coming to my lecture. Hope we'll see you all next week. Thanks.